group here. For the last 23 years or so, I've been working in Chicago on a number of ventures, some of them university related, but many of them having to do with ways in which people in low-income communities in particular can begin to get a hold on their lives and plug themselves into the mainstream of American life. That work for me now is it takes place at Northwestern University at the Center for Urban Affairs there, where I direct a new project called the Neighborhood Innovations Network. What we're trying to do is to rethink the question of poverty from a number of different angles, trying to see if it's possible to redeem what seems to us to be a decade of lost opportunities in terms of dealing with the question of poverty in the United States. just I think it's probably useful to just remind ourselves that both in terms of global and local, that is United States, poverty, we've basically been losing the battle since about 1976. If you look at poverty rates, both globally and in the United States, until about the mid-70s, there were solid signs of progress. In the United States, the poverty rate, that is the number of people who the government considered to be poor, went from about 30% in 1950 all the way down to about 11% in 1973. And it leveled off in 73 and began rising again, and it's now about 16%. So since about 82, both the absolute number of poor people in the United States and the proportion of the population that's back in poverty has been rising in the United States. The same thing is true globally. That is, we were making some progress in terms of the big global statistics until about the mid-70s. And since then, things have been getting worse again. Now, there are a lot of reasons for that, I think. But certainly one of them is that in the United States, just speaking domestically at this point, the federal government decided that it was not its business necessarily to attack poverty and to attack inequities in income and distribution of income. And that left a lot of concentrations of poor people growing. So the problem's getting worse, and it seems to us probably that as we turn the corner into the 1990s, there might be a new set of interests that might be interested, at least, in rethinking the question and readmitting the possibility that there's something we could do about it. So I think at the end of the Reagan era, there's a reason to rethink these questions. It's also true globally, by the way. I think that now's a wonderful time to rethink these questions as systems open up all over the place. That is, the sort of demarcation line between socialism and capitalism seems blurred all over the globe. And people, I think, when we're in that kind of an uncertain period, it's a marvelous time for people to ask systemic kinds of questions and to throw open all of the received categories in lots of ways. So I think this is the right time to rethink some of this stuff. Why focus on work for this morning's session? I suppose if I've got two things I've learned about poverty over the last 25 years, it is number one, that it's primarily an economic issue, that poor people don't have money. Not that they don't have the right characteristics. Not that they don't have the right services to treat those character defects, right? But that they don't have money. And along with the fact that they don't have money, they don't have power. They don't have any kind of control over their lives. I'll talk a little bit in a minute about why that might be the case. So for me, all of the social programs, all of the social services are about sustaining people in the absence of work, right? That's what social services are about. It seems to me that you've got two choices then if you want to deal with with poor people. You either build up more services to sustain them in the absence of work, or you work on the question of work and how it is you can recreate an economic base for people who've been cut off. I want to say a little bit about the problem, but I think it's probably a good idea to let me first share this brief 8-minute video with you. This is a piece from a couple of months ago on McNeil Lehrer, and it's about a factory a few blocks from my house in Chicago, and it is a video that's not about just this one factory, I think, as you'll see, but it's about what's happening to the economy and what's happening to people's work lives all over the United States. Let's just, because this one video, not only because it takes place next to my house, but because it raises all kinds of other issues, let me just share this one with you and see what you think about it.
Tonight, we look at a most important labor battle, the one over keeping U.S. manufacturing jobs from going abroad to low-wage third-world countries. Business correspondent Paul Salmon reports on a new tactic in Chicago.
We're gonna fight together, we shall not be alone.
Bet you haven't heard militant union songs like this in a while, but in the basement of a Chicago church, workers from a 76-year-old local firm, Stuart Warner, which manufactures industrial instruments, have come to make a desperate last stand. They're trying to prevent BTR, the British conglomerate that bought Stuart Warner 2 years ago, from closing their plant down. Attendants are members of Joanna Sullivan's family.
It's got to stop.
All right.
These people work at one of Stuart Warner's two Chicago plants. BTR intends to move the work to Texas and Mexico. Local investors say they want to buy the factory and keep the work in town, but BTR won't sell. So the only hope of keeping the jobs in Chicago seems to be new legislation recently proposed by Alderman Bernie Hanson.
We have learned that the old methods of saving factory jobs just doesn't work. This time has come to create a new approach.
The new approach is a legal technique known as eminent domain, which simply means the city of Chicago would seize the Stuart Warner plant slated for shutdown. Then the city would sell it to local investors.
Taking over a plant by eminent domain to keep it in town is a new tactic in the struggle between business and the community. But the struggle itself is an old one, pitting two very different economic perspectives against each other. On one side is the company, which shuts a plant because it views the economics narrowly in terms of maximizing its profits, cutting its losses. On the other side is the community. From its larger perspective, closing a plant is a total loss for its employees, for other local businesses, and even for taxpayers like you and me.
By using data from previous plant closings, it's possible to calculate what the Stuart Warner shutdown is likely to cost the community. So first, let's look at the loss to employees through the eyes of Joanna Sullivan's plant.
My sister got everybody in our family a job, cousin, sister, brother, husband, everyone. My sister got all of us jobs, Stuart Warner.
How many people altogether?
We have here, as now, 47.
But of the 47 family members who've worked at the plant, only 14 are left. 5 of them are here at the table. BTR has laid off more than 1,000 workers since it took over in 1987.
Some of them have went to GA, our General Assistance on Welfare. And some of them are just doing day work or just working day by day on whatever from the Job Corps.
We asked Joanne Sullivan how many people had found jobs.
Not too many. My son, he has a job, but it's not like this.
It certainly isn't. These people average nearly $10 an hour plus benefits. And how much does Sullivan's son make?
I don't know. I mean, I...
Well, we asked. 45 hours a week as a janitor in this Southside apartment house, no pay at all. He just gets a small apartment to live in and survives on food stamps, courtesy of the taxpayer. But afraid of losing even this job and winding up homeless, he backed out of an interview. But at least he has some options. Unlike his aunt, Patsy Abston.
Because if I leave Stuart Moore, if they lay me off today, I cannot go anywhere and get a job.
Why?
Because I've had one surgery in January and I've had four on one hand for the past 4 years. So I have tried to look for a job and I cannot work because my hands don't work.
What can you do with your hands? Can you move them like this?
Mm-hmm. I can turn them just like that. That's it.
And that's from Stuart Moore?
That's from being a punch bus operator, Stuart Moore, for the past 24 years.
And as a result of that, you can't get a job?
I cannot get a job.
Greg LeRoy has been studying plant closings for years. Some of the most substantive information on laid-off workers comes from his Midwest Center for Labor Research.
Effectively, what you have among a lot of the senior workers, especially, is that they never significantly re-enter the workforce. Maybe they get casual labor, maybe they go to the underground economy, maybe they just have de facto retirement and live off the income of relatives and family members.
LeRoy has been calculating the costs of plant closings to the community for years. We asked him to run the numbers for the Stuart Warner plant. The workforce here is mostly female, largely black. Given the past history of similar workers, you can make statistically reliable predictions of how much layoffs here will cost the community over a 2-year period. First, there are the increased costs of maintaining the social safety net. For example, unemployment compensation is likely to cost the government, and hence the taxpayer, an additional $11.18 million. General assistance or welfare will add another million or so. And then there's the predictable rise in food stamps, another 424,000. In addition to more government spending, layoffs also lead to less government revenue. Less local tax revenue, for example. There are fewer and fewer workers to patronize local businesses, like the recently defunct Capricorn Beauty Salon or the local bar, Mark and John.
Yeah, every time the people get laid off, everybody get hurt. All the business get hurt. Not only us, all around the area. Everybody
like,
get
like
hurt.
Like who?
Like the gasoline station. There was another restaurant down the street. There was another tavern down there with. And we are the only one left.
But even Mark and John's is up for sale. Its demise, just a matter of time. An old, once vital neighborhood that depended on Stuart Warner for its economic survival is essentially going out of business. Now, according to our tally sheet, the drying up of local business will cost city and state government $6.6 million in decreased revenues over the 2-year period. And add to that the loss of Illinois state income taxes, $1.9 million, and federal taxes, about $13.7 million, since people don't pay income taxes when their income's gone. Emmanuel Rose is Joanna Sullivan's ex-husband. After 24 years at the plant, he was laid off in November, and his fortunes have sagged dramatically ever since. Rhodes can't find a job and has racked up more than $5,000 in medical bills.
When my bills don't get paid, I really do not know how. I'm not able to pay them.
Rhodes had to move in here with his daughter when he developed diabetes. Medicare and the Cook County Hospital, supported by the government, are footing the bill. And medical expenses like this correlate with unemployment.
It's typical to have higher rates of stress-related diseases. Stress-related diseases like cardiovascular problems, heart attacks, high blood pressure, ulcers, alcoholism, cirrhosis of the liver. All those have been shown in higher incidence among chronically unemployed dislocated workers. You get higher rates of suicide, spouse abuse, child abuse, mental health admissions, crime.
Now, it's awfully hard to quantify human suffering, but it's clear that all this trauma costs the community, and medical costs at least can be translated into dollars. So add Medicaid to the tally, $286,000, and now we can finally sum up. An increase in social safety net spending of $12.9 million, a loss of $22.2 million in taxes, and so the layoffs at Stuart Warner in the first 2 years can be estimated to cost the community about $35 million, or about $20,000 per worker. But of course, the company looks at the economics of moving from an entirely different perspective. For years, Stuart Warner has been keeping a low media profile, consistently ducking interview requests, afraid to inflame the debate, since the company's always on the defensive when it's leaving town.
The company today announced a long-awaited decision to close the plant down.
But in November, Stuart Warner issued a press release explaining in a nutshell the economics of closing its Diversey Street plant.
Because most of our competitors obtain their products from lower cost areas of the world, we have to move our operations in order to survive.
And when company president Wes Kiley finally agreed to talk to us, he emphasized the same calculation.
The average rate in our Chicago factory hourly rate is approximately $10 an hour. In Texas, we would be paying a couple dollars an hour less than that. And if for our assembly operations in Mexico, we'd be paying substantially less than that.
In fact, Stuart Warner has for years been moving work from Chicago to the duty-free Maquiladora region of Mexico, along the Texas border. Wages here are about $1 an hour. Since buying Stuart Warner 2 years ago, British conglomerate BTR has simply continued the process. Because when the company runs the numbers, it figures wage rates plus the cost of operating an old plant compared to starting anew in cheaper climes. And the bottom line is that moving will save the company $17 million a year.
I think that just as American industry has to adjust to world competition, so society has to adjust to those changes. The idea that we're going to do everything in 1990 the way we did it in 1960 in the same locations, we're kidding ourselves.
To Kiley and Company, you keep the business competitive by moving. But to the community, you preserve jobs by reinvesting in what you've got. And there's now an offer to buy the plant from a corporate lawyer who used to run Chicago's Economic Development Commission, Tim Wright.
They figure they can milk the company probably all the way up until there's nothing left, and then simply dismantle it, and it's gone. And I see a different future for Stuart Warner. I see a future of new markets. I see a future of new contracts. I see a future of new areas that they have not focused on. I see a dedicated workforce that is going to do all it can to make it work.
But BTR has refused even to talk to Wright for two reasons.
First of all, there's no reason for us to sell the business. We know how to run it to make a profit. But secondly, this man has, I still don't feel it's a legitimate offer. He has no track record in any of this. It's easy to say all those things for publicity in the newspapers.
BTR won't sell. And that gets us back to the Stuart Warner rally and the community's current hope, seizing the plant by eminent domain and selling it to a local investor. To Mark Miller, however, editor of Crane's Chicago Business, eminent domain would be economic self-destruction.
To me, the trouble with eminent domain is that it sends a very negative signal about the business climate of Chicago to the rest of the country and to the world. It says that in Chicago, if we don't like the decisions that a company makes, we seize the assets and sell them to somebody else. That is not going to be good for bringing future jobs into Chicago, not only for those who lost their jobs at Stuart Warner, but in Chicago broadly.
In fact, while we were at his office, Miller was just correcting the copy of his latest editorial, arguing that with eminent domain, what you seize is what you get, an old factory on land the free market could put to better use. Better to let the plant close.
What's going to happen to this property now? The real estate will be sold and redeveloped to some purpose, either industrial or residential or commercial, and likely will go back on the tax rolls.
Take the Clybourne Corridor in a renovated factory district not far from Stuart Warner. A shopping mall has moved in, restaurants, there are even some small manufacturers down the block. In other words, goes the argument, in the long run, a free market economy must clean out the old to make way for the new. The process may be brutal, even unjust, to the community and especially to the employees who lose their jobs, but according to the business argument, that's the price you sometimes have to pay in the difficult process of adaptation to a new world. The community, of course, disagrees, arguing that adaptation doesn't happen soon enough if it happens at all. This old food processing plant, for example, just a few miles from Stuart Warner, is still rubble 4 years after it closed. The change, says the community, is too wrenching, renewal too slow, the price to society just too high. In the final economic analysis, however, it's simply a judgment call. Does the market produce so much more efficiently in the long run that it justifies its short-term brutality? Or can people in community manage the economic process more fairly while preserving the dynamism that keeps any economy alive? The analysis varies case by case, but the answer, in general, reflects basic beliefs, not numbers.
Well, reactions that I like a lot of things about that tape. It's a complicated story. I like it, particularly his last line. It says, this is about basic faith. This is about belief. This is not about economics and numbers. It's about what you believe, where your values are. Any reactions? Is the story clear in all of its complications?
My first thought was that Chicago's loss is going to be somebody else's gain. Texas, Mexico.
The strip along the Mexican border. Yeah.
I guess my first reaction was how devastating it is to the individual that doesn't have any way to support himself anymore. You know, just an individual, looking at an individual alone, he's lost everything.
Mm-hmm.
Somebody who previously had nothing has changed.
Mm-hmm. Although I suppose there's some questions about the maquiladoras and the ways in which the workforce there, at least arguably, in some of the plants along the Mexican border, seems to be getting less than a living wage. And there are a lot of controversies about what's going on down there on the border.
Yeah. $1 an hour.
It's $1 an hour.
That's $1 an hour that they didn't have before.
And they're really working for it.
Right. For a while, I was boycotting all the imported things like the tomatoes from Mexico. I thought I was doing the right thing.
Mm-hmm.
Until I went into the area and talked to the people. And they said, if it weren't for us, we would have nothing.
Yeah.
Don't stop buying our tomatoes.
Yeah. I think one of the questions, another reason this is so interesting to me is that it really captures in one little story the global nature of the economy these days, right? And the way in which all these decisions sort of interact. There's a struggle in Mexico about economic development policy. And the struggle is not dissimilar to this story. The struggle is about whether you put resources into rebuilding the economies of local towns and villages, right? Or whether you move people en masse to new concentrations of new industry, which is what this feeds into, right? So there's a sense in which the same kind of argument is going on among the Mexican government folks that's going on here in the United States about these questions. So they may or may not be better off moving up to the Mexican border. And if the option was rebuilding their own communities where they were, that might have been better. Any other reactions to that story?
Well, the comment was also made that they closed down the factory, it will probably maybe even be torn down, but it will come back on the market as possibly industrial property again, which would probably create some jobs, but there would be a transition period where people some of these same people might be hired for a new company. However, there would be transition period where they probably have
nothing. Yeah, I think that what's actually going to happen, and the report wasn't as clear about this, what's actually going to happen is that the building, which is a beautiful old industrial building, there are a few shots of it, is going to be bought by real estate developers who will turn it into condominiums. And it will be housing for upper middle class folks and not for folks who've been in the neighborhood. So it will also be a kind of, it will aid in the quote unquote gentrification of that part of town. And move a lot of these people out of the area. I think that's probably what's going to happen. I guess overall why I like this little piece is that it underlines in so many different ways how it is that we are in an entirely new ballgame in 1990 when we think about these questions. I think it's the Stuart Warner president who said you can't think about these questions in 1990 the way you did in 1960, and I think that's really right. And it's as right for those of us who think as a matter of faith about the community as it is for the president of Stuart Warner. My own biases tend to be in the community direction on this battle, but his truth is true for us as well as for him. I jotted down after looking at this again, four things that leap out of this tape for me that are typical, it seems to me, and absolutely central to what it is we're facing in 1990 in terms of thinking about the economy globally. Just run them down briefly. Economists talk about the economy developing unevenly. Uneven development, that some places are boom places and others are bust places. So in Chicago, you've got a booming downtown right next to absolutely devastated poor neighborhoods. I don't know if that's true in Salem, whether there are parts of Oregon that are boom and parts that are bust. You've got the logging questions, I suppose, there at this point, right? In general, that seems to be true, though, with cities, that there are increasingly cities or places where there are rich folks and poor folks, and not very many middle-income or even stable working-class people anymore. That development takes place in a very uneven kind of way.
Salem's poverty is unique in that we have all of the state government here in a relatively small town.
Uh-huh, that's right.
And we also have the state mental institution,
right.
We have the state prison.
Right.
And everybody is feeding their rejects, that is, rejects isn't the word, what am I saying? When you get out of prison,
sure.
The parolees, the hospital people, all get in Salem with no place to live, no occupations, and so on.
Huh.
So that's our core. It's the recently
deinstitutionalized. Uh-huh. Well, that's interesting. That's a set of questions.
And an influx of migrants who come increasingly early and have no place to work.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Let's think about that in terms of what can be done in a second here. Just quickly, other obvious things. If all the economists tell us that what it is that produces work is the combination of labor and capital, what we're seeing here is that capital investment is global now, right? It's mobile, it goes all over the globe in seconds by computers, and there isn't that sort of local route to capital anymore that we used to be able to depend on, for better or for ill. The other thing this thing points up to me is what you see every day in merger mania, the massive increase in size of enterprises, the ways in which enterprises get more and more globalized in their scope. And then finally, the decrease in industrial jobs. In Chicago, in my town, we've lost something like 400,000 jobs like these that are $10 an hour jobs. We've increased some other kinds of jobs, and that's, it seems to me, that opens up then the question of what to do about this. The kinds of jobs that are growing, and Salem probably is a good example of this, are service sector jobs, not the old manufacturing jobs. What seems clear at the end of the 80s, though, is that the service sector jobs are of two kinds. They really sort of go off in two directions. And at the top end are the good, say, government jobs, or the good information systems jobs, or the good banking and finance kinds of jobs, where people get a good education, get a high amount of training, and get compensated for that kind of training and education. So that something like a third of the new jobs that got created in the 80s look like they're that kind of job. They've got a good future. You know, yuppies do exist. People who come out of college law schools in Chicago and join the big law firms at this point, come out of law school to $80,000 a year, which is fairly substantial wages for a 25-year-old recent law school graduate. So clearly some of the service sector job expansion is at that level. But two-thirds, it seems to us now, something like this, two-thirds of the jobs that are being created are not of that character at all. They're low wage, basically dead end, basically boring, and basically unplugged from any need for training or education. Right? And in some of those jobs, the more training and education you've got, the worse off you are. We sometimes talk about this as the McDonaldization of the economy, where all jobs are like McDonald's jobs, and the job turnover at McDonald's is something like 3 months. They just come and they go. And when you get a workforce that goes in 3 months, you've got to mechanize and robotize almost everything, right? So you don't even have to read, really, what a Big Mac looks like, and you punch that, and that will tell you how much money you're supposed to be collecting. I think an awful lot of the new jobs look like those kinds of jobs. And the kinds of people who get laid off at Stuart Warner will be in those jobs, in that two-thirds of the new service sector, if at all, and not in the one-third. I think what that does is to really make us rethink the old, sometimes we think about the United States as a ladder of opportunity, sort of where you sort of step on the first rung and you get yourself a little bit of security, and then you get to the point where you own a little bit of stuff, and then finally, if you really make it, you get to the point where your capital makes capital, right, and you're accumulating all kinds of stuff. I think in Chicago, I'm not sure, and it could be true at least for deinstitutionalized people in a place like Salem, what we've got is increasingly no first run. Right? When our foremothers and forefathers came to cities anyway, they didn't have to speak English. All they had to do, they didn't have to have an education, all they had to do was to be ready to work, to be willing to put in, at that point, a 10-hour and then an 8-hour day, doing often back-breaking labor at the Stuart Warners or the steel mills or wherever. But they knew that if they did that, they'd be able to accumulate enough money to buy a house, to make some kind of stability for their family, so that their kids could get an education and get into the real mainstream of middle America. That first set of opportunities, good pay for not much education, it seems to me is just not there anymore. And to expect people to replicate this sort of ladder of opportunity when the first rung is missing, where there's no place to grab onto, seems to me to be one wrong set of expectations. And then the challenge becomes, part of the challenge, how can we recreate that first rung? How is it possible to take the deinstitutionalized folk in Salem, or the laid off Stuart Warren workers, multiplied by thousands and thousands all over the place, and recreate an economy, recreate some kind of good work. Let me just say a couple of things about that, and then I hope that you have better ideas than I do how to do that. I want to say two things about that. Number one, as Christian people, it seems to me we bring some resources to this discussion, which we should probably be aware of. That it's not that sometimes isn't there in a discussion that includes only economists and policy people. You just list three simple ones. It seems to me clearly that anybody who reads the New Testament understands who it was that Jesus ate with and talked with most of the time, and understands part at least of our impetus to be with and to stand with poor folks, not to adjust them to their poverty, but to deal with them with the realities that face them. So that's the first thing. It seems to me clearly we bring a concern for the poor. The second thing that we bring, it seems to me, as Christian folks, is a concern for community. And this is directly relevant to the video, I think. I mean, it seems to me that there's some kind of a value to the people of God. To an idea of community that comes to us out of the New Testament, certainly parts of the Old Testament as well, that is important in defining people's worth and well-being. And I think finally, thirdly, what Christian folks can bring to these discussions is a concern that when we're thinking about work, we're thinking about good work. We're not just thinking about labor to earn wages, to consume more, but we're thinking about work that is meaningful, work that gives back to the community, work that provides people with a kind of depth of meaning in their lives that is sustaining and creative and productive. There's a lot about work, it seems to me, both in the Bible and in Luther, in his notion of vocation, that points us to a different way of thinking about work. So it seems to me a Christian might approach the challenge of revising our economic life by saying that we are about looking for ideas and structures and policies that promote economic justice, build community, and enable and sustain good work. Those three things. That's just sort of guidelines for what we're about. Well, I think there are people who are doing that. And I guess I'd like to hear from you if you think there are people who are doing that too. The two things I suppose you do when you look at the situation of poor people in relationship to work is you try to retain what's there and you try to create what isn't, I suppose, right? In terms of retaining jobs, let me just end anything that I'm saying here with a couple of quick stories. The same outfit that was on the tape, the Midwest Center for Labor Research, has looked at the job retention question in Chicago, and it's beginning now in other cities too. And they've been trying to figure out why it is that not only the Stuart Warners of the world, but other plants are leaving poor communities. And they decided to look at the smaller outfits, the outfits that employ between 25 and 100 people on the west side of Chicago, which is a very poor African-American community. What they found was that something like 50% of those plants did plan at some point in the next 5 years to leave or to close the west side of Chicago. Thousands more jobs gone, thousands more people on unemployment, all of the social costs and so forth going up. So they asked why. Why are you thinking about closing and leaving? Well, it turns out that of that 50% that are thinking about leaving, 60% of those are leaving because they can't, they're a single family operation who can't figure out, don't have any sons or daughters coming along to take over the business, right? There's no way for them to sort of hand it over to somebody in the family. It's been a family business the whole time, and there just isn't anybody. So, creatively enough, this is about sort of creative, what strikes me as creative approaches. Creatively enough, what the Midwest Center decided to do was to say, okay, what if we found you people who would take over your business, who would keep the name, and who would keep the business going in the community. So what they've been about is finding basically black and Hispanic entrepreneurs, people who are ready and nearly capable, at least in terms of finances, of buying a business. And they've been matching these found entrepreneurs with the businesses that are about to close and figuring out what the loans and the financial deals and so forth. The result is that a community that hasn't had very much of a base in terms of black business and Hispanic business is getting a base now made up of folks who are taking over businesses that otherwise would have closed and left. So that sort of marriage making and sort of matchmaking stuff is going on, and I think that that's one kind of approach to take. Let me tell one other quick story. There are lots of possible examples, but this is one that's interesting when I think about deinstitutionalized people and other folks really at the margins of the economy. The most exciting entrepreneurial venture, it seems to me, in the world is probably the Grameen Bank in Bangladesh. Does anybody know about the Grameen Bank in Bangladesh? It's a terrific story, and we're trying to apply some of their lessons in Chicago and New York and some other places. What the Grameen Bank in Bangladesh does, there's so much to learn from the third world, it seems to me, that we need to learn for our own cities and for our own approaches to poverty. What the Grameen Bank has done is to figure out a way to make very, very small loans, micro loans, to very, very poor people. Bangladesh is, I think, the third poorest country in the world, right? And these are people who are absolutely without anything. I mean, they're what the economists, global economists, call their absolute poverty. Clothing, food, shelter, all struggles. What the Grameen Bank has done is made over 500,000 micro loans to people. It's average $65, $65 loans to start businesses. And the trick is to get a group of, it's mostly women who are getting these loans. And what happens is they get a group of about five women together as a team. Each of the women draws up a business plan, what it is they'd like to do. I'd like to sew, or I'd like to do these kinds of crafts and so on, or I'd like to open a kind of cooking business. And they figure out what it is they need to do that in terms of capital investment. That is, do I need a loom? Do I need a sewing machine? Do I need a space to work in? And the Grameen Bank then tailors its loans for those initial capital expenditures. They stay in groups of five, and what happens is that the group of five decides, let's loan it to Doris first. Doris has a good plan. We'll loan this first we'll get Doris's $65 first. If your plan is the second one, you don't get your $65 until Doris has begun paying hers back. So the five of us all help Doris get on her feet with her sewing business and start paying back the loan before you can get your money, and then open your business. And then the five of us help you get on your feet, and then the third loan gets given. So that there's a kind of collective responsibility for getting people into the economy, right? Which seems to work here too. We're starting it in a few communities in Chicago, and there are other people in New York looking at it at this point. It's clear that one of the things that does is, at a very modest level, tries to recreate this bottom step. Is there a way to put people enough into the economy so that they can begin to be not dependent anymore on the public dole and begin to be somehow independent economic actors? I think that's an exciting kind of model, partly because it does create community as it goes, too. It does create a kind of culture of people striving and helping each other to get back on their economic feet. Well, that is enough from me. One of the things I'm doing these days is to try to collect people's stories about what's working in rebuilding the economy at this point, as well as trying to understand better myself what needs to be done. Any of you in Salem or any place else have any? Have you come across stuff that seems to you to be replugging people into the economy in ways that make sense?
I'm from such an affluent community.
You don't run into the poor folks down there in Thousand Oaks much.
Very few.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I think that's one of our problems, that we are increasingly separated from these questions.
I was reading up in the portal yesterday about when Holden Mine closed down and how devastated Chelan was and how happy they were that the church was going to start a facility up here. I guess that's kind of the same story.
Sure. Sure. And those workers got, a couple hours notice, I think, when the mine closed down? And all those stories about finding meals uneaten on the tables up there because they ran
clothes
down.
Clothes still hanging on the line.
That's
we were
right
here to see that.
Is that right?
Mm-hmm.
people just fled down the hill to get
wagon
to get
over
the next
here.
Job. Huh. Yeah, there was certainly a moment of panic and desperation up at this place when it closed down.
I guess I wonder how far the individual makeup has to go and what you can do with people. I know our kids have been bullied, but we're always saying it's not what you make, it's how you manage what you make. That you know, you don't go out to your first job and start lining up time payments for all this expensive stuff, but you stash it away, and you use that for education to, in turn, go higher. I think of all these refugees, that the boat people that come in with nothing, and within a couple of years, they're owning restaurants,
that's right.
employing family that's right. members, and what's the difference in the makeup? Maybe it has to do with the national background of the work ethic and the whole thing. But some people can start with nothing, and others people start with large amounts, and 10 years later are in the same route of work.
Sure.
But that's what we do. We do have some boat people and people like that that we've taken into the community and are trying to get on their feet. But they do it themselves, really.
Yeah.
A very little help.
It's interesting, people, actually there was a discussion yesterday in Sarah Naylor's session about the immigration question, people were trying to figure out what's the difference between at least the substantial success that Southeast Asians have in starting businesses and being entrepreneurs and so forth, and how is that different from the experience, for instance, of segments of the black community in cities and so forth. It seems to me, once one understands what's happened to the economy, that the answer to that is pretty clear, right? I mean, the folks who are coming from Southeast Asia are coming with large families and with some entrepreneurial background. I mean, they've hustled in villages and income in large part that's what they've done. That's what they're used to. The folks who came north into cities from the south in the United States came up to do factory work, basically, and had no background as entrepreneurs because they couldn't own anything in the south, right? They were basically used to being labor for large operations, first on plantations and then in industry. So that there's a whole different kind of economic culture. It's not necessarily lack of a work ethic, but it's about a different way of building an economy. And trying to work on the entrepreneurial ethic in an African American community is very different from working on it in an immigrant Asian community. It's just two very different sort of ways of relating to the economy, I think. But it is fun to watch those folks put it together, because they do it as a group. They
right.
don't do it individually.
Well, some people, I guess I'm getting more hardened the older I get and the more I see of people who are given opportunities and throw them away. I think of in Portland recently, they pulled a bunch of people out from the bridges and cleaned up these camps. And one fellow opened his motel, and he was going to give them a month's free lodging in his motel so that they could have, you know, phone and get out and get jobs, and they were just going to build up and they got from there. Well, after about 2 weeks, he kicked him out because they had absolutely trashed his motel. I mean, torn out facilities and the lavatories and broken windows, and just he couldn't have it even for a month.
I think what you're doing is applying your experience and your kind of lived world on the people who have no idea about what it is to live with four walls around.
And yet some of these people presumably have been doctors and lawyers, and the
people
under the bridge aren't all.
Most of their lives have lived under the bridge.
I don't think so.
And lived on the street and did what they can to get by. So the concept of living the way we live, apartment, or having to cook meals, having to do the regular activities of daily living that keep us going from day to day, it's completely foreign to a lot of them.
As I say, this friend who works with those claims always tells me that the people that she meets in the line of her work have come from real professional people.
A lot of them.
If
certainly
for one
it's
reason
a mixed,
or another,
it's a mixed set of backgrounds you're dealing with.
Whatever.
Another dynamic here, part of what you're talking about, it seems to me, leads one to say it's awfully important to give people ownership or to have folks get ownership over what it is they're dealing with, whether you're dealing with a house or a job. I mean, you're describing a situation, obviously, in which people didn't feel like whatever this motel was, it was theirs, right? And people don't do that to their own stuff. They probably didn't do it when they were living under the bridge. One of the interesting things that's happening in public housing developments across the country is turning over the management of those public housing developments to the folks who live there. And in some, moving from management to ownership of those housing units. And as people get ownership, as they begin to feel that this is theirs, you know, this is not something, you know, this is not somebody else's, this is my responsibility, this is my place, the places change.
This is what we've been trying to build up here in Holden, a feeling of ownership.
Ownership by everybody who's here.
Yeah.
That's right. That's right. Sure, and on those few occasions when something else happens at Holden, it's because people don't feel like it's their place. Yeah. That's right.
Very important.
So you don't think it's necessarily the answer to kind of pluck people off the street and drop them into an apartment and say, okay, now thrive.
That's right. No, I don't think so.
I really don't think that's the way, because it's so different from this person's lived experience.
Yeah.
But you've got to start somewhere.
That's right. Yeah. That's a question about where it is you start. And different people are interested, it seems to me, in starting in different places in their life.
I guess where I've started in my work with these folks with chronically mentally ill is trying to understand where they're coming from and what their life experience is. Mm-hmm. And trying to tailor kind of a care plan, I guess, to where they're coming from.
Sure.
So it'll work.
Yes.
Because trying to imply what I think is the good life, or this is how you get a foot, you know, get a leg up and get into life, and you do this and you'll be okay, it just doesn't work.
Mm-hmm.
So what do you do? Well, I mean, you say tailor plan, but what does that involve?
Well, first of all, it involves getting into a relationship with a person and being able to understand where they're coming from. That's the most difficult and most time. I work with a mental health agency.
I mean, do you actually go out to the streets to find these people one-on-one as they come to you?
Yeah, that's part of what I do.
And are they willing to come?
No, not all the time. Because, again, their lived experience is to not trust people. To not really trust that this person is going to really help me. Because all their lives, people have not kept them around. So that's the most difficult and the most time-consuming activity with my clients, is getting into a relationship with them.
Sure.
That's what you're talking about, community. That's what we're trying to do at my mental health agency, is build community.
Mm-hmm.
Are many of the people that you're talking about happy just the way they are, however?
I don't know if it's necessarily a question of happiness, it's a question of continuous surviving.
And not knowing what else to do, right?
Yeah. A lot of the people that I work with are so caught up in their world that it's so hard to relate to anything else that's going on. They hear voices, they have unusual beliefs, they have problems controlling their emotions. There's just so many different things going on within their world that the idea of an economy, you know, or having to cook a meal is just so beyond them. Big thing to do.
I wonder what percentage of our homeless are mentally ill and how many are in the category of the people in this industry.
Varies from state to state, I think. Overall, you remember, John, it's something like the deinstitutionalized mentally ill is something like a third of homeless people in most big cities. I think that's about what it is in Chicago. So it's a large part, but not the majority of the population.
It's a
Sailor.
Different approach for different folks.
That's right.
In Salem, it's higher than that.
Is it higher than that?
There are so many institutions, and theoretically they get they're deinstitutionalizing the community care, but in fact, the community care just really isn't there in a big enough quantity to take care of them. They just get lost.
Sure.
Besides, how do you really take care of them in the community? You can't really make them go to a certain place, I don't think, for an appointment or stay in a certain place if they want to wander around. It's kind of hard to drive them back.
Yeah.
And so they probably reject, some of them probably reject any care that could be given them.
Yeah.
And I don't know how you deal with somebody who really doesn't want.
Not necessarily reject, but find it hard to believe that it's really good.
Well,
so I think also
reject. Some of them really prefer to just flip by themselves and be out on their bridge or somewhere.
One of the things, this doesn't have anything to do necessarily with the economic reintegration, but one of the things we've been working on in one community in Chicago is finding all the people who come from that community. This is a sort of low-income / working-class community, mostly Hispanic. Finding all the folks who come from that community who have been institutionalized, who are mentally and physically challenged in some way, and getting to know them, this is a group of people doing this work, getting to know them and putting them in relationships with workplaces and family situations in the community, not institutions in the community, but workplaces and family situations. So about 60 of them in this community are more or less regularly reintegrated into community life. Not necessarily with a group home or some sort of institution set in the community at this point, but just because the community has reopened itself up to the possibility that they can include these kinds of folks, right? That's been really interesting to watch.
I really find it difficult to swallow, and I didn't swallow myself the idea of the rugged individual mentality, pull yourself up by your bootstraps, independence is the way to go. I don't believe that, I guess, anymore. I guess I'm more into an interdependence, you know, getting people
in sort of reality. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, thank you, Salemites and John.
thank you, Joe.
I enjoyed that a lot.
These are tough questions. I hope we can keep working on them in some way that is productive.
I will. Yep.